This morning, in this first hour, we will return to a subject that we've discussed. Generally speaking, we've discussed quite a lot on the program, something that interests us, and that's architecture. We've talked a lot about what architects do. We have talked about why it is that we respond to certain buildings the way that we do, why we like some and not like others. We've talked about the relationship between people who design buildings and then those people who actually have to build the designs. And we've talked about historic preservation. We've talked about a number of things. And generally with one of the guests that we have with us here this morning, Bill Rose. He's a research architect with the Building Research Council, and it's a part of the School of Architecture here at U of I. And he's been with us before, and we've talked about these various and sundry things. We asked him to come back this morning and talk about a specific topic. And sometimes the conversations we have do have a particular focus we try to concentrate on. And we thought we'd talk a little bit about designing and building affordable housing. Now, one of the things certainly we know is that across the country, in big cities and small towns, there is a real need for affordable housing. We'll try to talk a little bit about what it is when we use that phrase and the role that architects can play and are playing in meeting that need. And in addition to having with us Bill Rose, we also have Lynn Dearborn. She is Assistant Professor of Architecture at the University of Illinois and has been on the faculty here since 2002. And this is an issue that she's particularly interested in and has been involved in various places that she has been when she was working on her PhD at University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and also during the time that she was teaching at University of Oregon. Here, she is an active member of the university's East St. Louis Action Research Project, where she teaches design studios and other courses that are all focused on improving conditions in East St. Louis, Illinois. As we talk, as always, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have that toll-free line. That's good anyway. You can hear us, 800-222-9455. Thank you both very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
One of the things I guess I think we should do at the beginning is, I'd say this a lot, I think probably on this program, is talk about what it is we're talking about. And because I think over time, the kind of terminology that we use has changed. I think more clearly, there was a time when people were talking more about low-income housing. That was the kind of phrase that you saw to describe what it was we're talking about. And I think now we have abandoned that term in favor of the term affordable, which I think is probably more broad and makes the point that we really need a range of housing in this country. And there's a big part of the range that we need that we really don't have, or that there's a shortage. So if I ask the question, well, what do you mean by affordable housing? What do you mean?
Affordable housing really goes to the notion of, at a certain point, we said people should spend not more than 25% of their income on their housing. That's crept up over the years to 30%, and now it's somewhere between 30 and 35%. So that number, of course, varies depending on someone's income or the household income. And so that's where and as the cost of housing has risen out of proportion to incomes rising, that the people who fall in that range of not meeting that criteria grows.
Yeah.
So in San Francisco, for example, people with quite high incomes have a housing affordability problem. They're spending more than 30 to 35% of their income on their housing just because the cost of housing is so high and in such great demand. Here in Champaign, it's not as big a problem for as great a number of people, although there are still a lot of people who have a housing affordability issue.
Hmm. Well, if then, given that this is sort of a relative issue, that it depends on individual's income, and it also depends on what is the average price of housing wherever you happen to be. Say if we talked about a single family home, what's the sort of the average sort of price ranges that we're talking about where the housing isn't there? Is it possible to answer a question like that?
Again, that depends on your geographic location. In San Francisco, that might be anything up to $250,000, $300,000 or more. In large cities, it's a bigger issue. When we moved to the South, actually, in there was a study that was done in 2002 where they showed that in some parts of the South, Louisiana, for example, housing affordability is actually housing has become more affordable over the past few years. But in most places, it is increasingly less affordable.
Mm. So in some places, you'd say it's difficult to find a house for less than $250,000. And then in other places, you'd say, well, here we're talking about it's difficult to find a house for, let's say, under $70,000. It's all going to depend on where you are.
Right. The marketplace is the biggest determinant of the cost of housing, both for new housing as well as for rental housing. The market, however, is rigged a little bit where policy intervenes, where rents are stabilized in New York City, for example, and where rents are pegged using a formula in, for example, HUD's Section 8 housing. But for the most part, the marketplace makes these determinations of how much housing is going to cost, and it's up to people to deal with that. But one of the ways that the government, HUD, for example, is trying to influence the marketplace is through their emphasis on affordable housing that goes to reducing the cost of housing, reducing the expense of new construction. Mm-hmm. And here they have a curious relationship with the National Association of Home Builders. What's the interest of the National Association of Home Builders? Well, it's making a profit. But the interest of HUD, giving it the benefit of the doubt, is to make housing affordable for the U.S. population, both in inner city as well as rural populations. And I might also point out that one of our greatest sources of affordable housing is in manufactured housing. And the code that governs manufactured housing is managed through HUD. So when we talk about affordable housing, I think we have to talk about the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development to a great extent. But what's funny in this relationship between HUD, whose interest is in ensuring good housing for the population, and the National Association of Home Builders, is they both have an interest in lowering the expense side of the ledger. It's just that the actual cost, whether the money goes to lower rents or lower housing costs or to greater profits, sort of depends on the level of control that's exerted. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interest in reducing housing expense, but it doesn't always translate into reducing housing cost for the occupants.
Well, I'm sure that there's a big difference in real estate costs from one place to another. But if you ask the question, what about the cost of new construction? Say that you were going to build a house. Is there really very much difference in how much it costs to build a house, say, in central Illinois? And you can compare that with California, for, you know, to pick one state out of the air.
In general, no. The U.S. In the past has had four model building codes, and these determined how, and the four were largely similar, except that the code that was used widely in California and the eastern United States had stiffer structural requirements. Well, one of these codes was called the Uniform Building Code. One was called the Basic Building Code. One was called the National Building Code. And one was called the Standard Building Code. But we didn't have a standard, basic, national, uniform building code until the architects, among others, started saying maybe it's time for a single building code for the U.S. One of the problems was that all of these adjectives had been garnered by these individual organizations, and so they had to find another one. They called it the International Building Code. To the extent that this building code is adopted by municipalities or states, the cost will sort of be able to, you can pull it right out of the costs of materials, which are rather uniform around the United States, except for Alaska, where they have to travel by boat, and by the code to which they're built. However, in some areas, codes are stiffer than in others. For example, where there are stiff energy codes, the costs can go up. But otherwise, the costs are pretty standard across the United States. And it's location, 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 it seems, mm-hmm. that determines the eventual cost of the units.
We're talking here this morning in this part of Focus 580 a little bit about designing and building affordable housing. And we have two guests, Bill Rose. He's a research architect with the Building Research Council at U of I. And he's certainly been here before on the program to talk about various kinds of architectural topics. Our other guest is Lynn Dearborn. She's assistant professor of architecture at University of Illinois, something she's very much interested in and has been throughout her academic career. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to return to something that I think Bill touched on and something that seems to come up whenever you get into the subject, that it is somehow we have this idea, and I don't know if that's a popular idea and an idea that people have in the building industry, but I kind of think that it's both. That is that you can't make money building affordable housing. You know, that you can, if you want to make money, you got to build $250,000 houses and up. And if you're thinking about wanting to build a kind of a house or a kind of housing that will meet the needs of somebody who is in the market for a $50,000 house or a $70,000 house, something under $100,000, that you just can't do that. And then, in fact, if we want that kind of housing, the government's got to get involved and provide some kind of subsidies because industry just can't do that.
Well, I think that it's true to a certain extent. There, right now, in order to produce particularly housing that's affordable to people who are at 50% of median income, for example, and under, in most places there is some subsidy required from somewhere. It's almost impossible given that we have standard building costs. But as you move up a little bit, there are developers who do make a good living by volume primarily, as opposed to when you're doing larger, more expensive houses, obviously you don't have to do as many of them to make the same amount of money. So, you know, if your profit is a percentage. So that's kind of, you know, where that comes from. But when we look at particularly the lower spectrum of affordable housing, there does need to be subsidies from a number of different sources, be it government, nonprofit developers as opposed to for-profit developers, or teams of nonprofit for-profit developers doing the housing development is advantageous.
I might also mention that there are some builders who just they seem rich in building low-income, affordable housing. I'm thinking in particular of one, Perry Bigelow, in the Chicagoland area. He's one of these entrepreneur types, dreamer, visionary, who seems to relish the particular task that he's taken on, and that is of building affordable housing, just more and more. And I mean, you can't sort of grow in this vision without making enough money. I haven't really seen people involved in building affordable housing for the profit only. The people I've seen who've been involved have always had a little more something going for them, and I think it keeps them going through hard times. But I think in the end, it probably gives them greater satisfaction.
Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. We can do that, and the caller is in Chicago on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering if we're talking about, or we need to talk about, more than affordable housing, but maybe affordable communities, in the sense that we also need affordable transportation. We need public transportation. And I really feel, looking at what's happening with us, this country demographically, with the fact that we want to bring in workers who we expect to work at a very, very low income, we are at a point with our infrastructure where I think we need to do planning on a big scale, maybe regional, maybe interstate, and develop communities where There is affordable and rational transportation that would facilitate workers going back and forth. I just feel like we need to be planning and not just talking about individual developers building houses, but it's going to have to be the government coming in as well and really sitting down and putting aside politics, which seems almost impossible in this day and age, and do some rational planning to not only conserve our resources, but to promote the resource of humans and their labor.
Well, I think it's a great point the caller makes. You want to comment on it?
The actual cost of housing, what people pay for their mortgage or their rent every month, is only one component of what we want to think about when we're thinking about affordability. The cost of transportation clearly is another issue that needs to be added into that equation. Oftentimes, land costs are cheaper the further you move away from the center of urban areas. Therefore, that's where the lower or more affordable housing tends to be built. But likewise, there are other components, for example, energy costs. It may cost more to super insulate a house to start with, but over the term of that house, while people are living there, that's going to reduce their housing costs in terms of what they're paying for oil or gas. So I think there's a number of components. In terms of the issue of transportation, one good example to look at is in the Metro East area in St. Louis, which an area that I'm familiar with. The Metrolink has actually been extended into East St. Louis and now gives people the opportunity in East St. Louis, where there's not a lot of opportunities for employment. People can get on the Metrolink and actually go to work at the airport, in the St. Louis airport, to downtown St. Louis. So it's really opened up a whole new set of opportunities simply by having mass transit available that's clean, efficient, and easy to use.
I'm just wondering if the government is, at any level, whether state or federal, is planning for this. I guess I just remember what happened in England. In England, they pushed out from London. As London got more expensive, they pushed people out of the city, and they were in, as you said, further from the city. The land was cheaper, and they built up housing complexes. And these people were practically, they were almost isolated in low-income places where there was no transportation out. And then in the late 80s, there were riots in that area because people were almost, they were like isolated spots of poverty where with no transportation. And England has a better public transportation system than we have, but that still happened there. And when I see Mayor Daley not wanting to, as he destroys the housing project, planning not to build more affordable housing, and a lot of people being pushed down to suburbs in Section 8 housing, I have visions of this happening in the future here.
There's a slight cultural difference between here and England in that we are married to the car in the United States. Now, it's not to say that it's not important for us to think about public transportation, but I do think that we look at it a little bit differently. It's unusual to have a lot of households that don't have access to some sort of vehicular transportation, although not unheard of, certainly. And just running the numbers in from the latest census in East St. Louis, in the neighborhood that I'm working in, and there are 40% of the households that don't have access to cars. So it is an issue, particularly in low-income communities, and I do think it's something that needs to continually be kept in the forefront of this whole discussion.
Well, I hope that there's some discussion of that. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, it seems to me that what the caller does point to is one of the, historically in this country and probably other places, one of the failures of our efforts in public housing. And that is that we sort of forgot what communities were all about, and that people had a range of needs a place to sleep at night was one of them, but there are a lot of other things that go into community. People have to have work. They have to have a way to get to work. They have to have some place to go to the grocery. They have to have a pharmacy so they can buy stuff like that. They've got to be able to go to get to church, and their kids have to be able to get to school, and you hope that there are other sort of community institutions, and that all you need all of those sorts of things. And that we completely, when we came along and wiped out whole neighborhoods and then built housing for people and said, okay, here you go, good luck, we completely forgot all of these other things that go into making a community.
I think that's true. And I think one of the reactions by HUD to the failures of public housing in the mid part of the century was their Section 8 program, in which they sought to have affordable housing units be interspersed among the entire marketplace. That is, there was no attempt to segregate, but indeed to integrate these units within the larger communities. But this only puts off the questions of what goes into a good community. There's sort of a presumption that we won't be doing community building, but instead we will presume that it's being done, and that we'll have affordable housing spread more evenly throughout the community. I think the point that the caller made, and that is that this isn't just a lumber, nails, and brick issue by any means. This is how do we build good communities. Is never off the table, even when we adopt integrative programs like Section 8, or there are others, I'm sure, who are more familiar with some of the good and bad examples of efforts along those lines.
The other thing that goes into this equation is the issue of zoning. And at the turn of the century, because of the Industrial Revolution, we had conditions that were not healthy, where we had housing next to industry and so on. And so zoning was instituted over time, and what it did was segregate uses. And one of the issues that we now have is zoning is a tool which segregates land uses. So you can't have commercial development finally interspersed with housing, for example, or other employment opportunities, a very fine mix of those, because oftentimes the zoning regulations don't allow it for particular classes of zoning, and oftentimes single-family residential is one of those classes. And it's sort of become a crutch for us in a way to not allow a better mix, a more livable, habitable community with those mix of uses very close together so that people can walk places, for example.
Well, I got a couple of calls here. I hope these folks wouldn't mind waiting for a minute or two, but I just make the connection between some of the things we've been talking about and architecture. This seems to be a natural thing for architects and students of architecture to be interested in, and I'm sure that in schools, architecture schools across the country, there are people who are getting assignments to design stuff like this. How, though, given the fact that most of those things will never be built, and in fact that probably most people will never live in an architect-designed house, what sort of role is there for architects not only to design, you know, draw pictures of housing like this, but actually get housing like that built?
Well, I think one of the architects that we could look at, for example, is Michael Piatek, who works primarily, or his offices are in Oakland, California, and in Seattle, Washington. And one of the things that he does in his practice is a lot of participation by people who might become residents of these housing complexes. So what we call a design charrette, to really find out what are the issues for this particular group of people, be they low income, moderate income, seeking homeownership or renting, immigrants from various backgrounds. What are the kinds of things that they're needing and wanting in their housing? And one of the things that he's really been pushing recently is this whole idea of live-work housing for not live-work housing as we think of in the kind of live-work lofts that the yuppies tend to want to go toward, but live-work housing that allows the opportunity for people to have income-generating activities in their home, be it home daycare, fixing bicycles, or whatever. So allowing the house to be flexible enough so that space can be set aside for some of these income-generating activities without causing undue stress on the rest of the neighborhood or on the neighbors. So that requires a pretty sensitive approach to thinking about design, for example. Mm-hmm. The other issue related to design is thinking about how moderate income housing and affordable housing fits into a given context. And if we think about the public housing of the past, where things really stuck out because they were designed in a monolithic way to, you know, big blocks, the approach is exactly the opposite. Look at what's going on around. If it's small scale, have your design represent small scale, so it's broken down, has, you know, different kinds of detailing as opposed to much larger scale.
Well, why don't we take some more calls here? We have someone in Wellington there next, line number one. Hello?
Yes. I got a couple things to say. You see it here, and the lady mentioned about in England, which was kind of interesting. Even in our area, we see a lot of people moving down from Chicago and young couples that were just starting out in life would maybe buy, you know, a rural farmhouse or something, and you're finding that they're being a lot of times priced out of the market in their hometowns. And, you know, a more exaggerated version of this is in resort places like Aspen or Steamboat Springs or something, that children are pretty much driven out of the community because they can't afford housing that's affordable when it comes time for the turnover of the generations. And then the lady mentioned about in England, I was in London in a farm and watched on BBC a program that I thought was kind of interesting. They were talking about that the price of housing has become so high in England that a lot of people are English are moving over into France, and particularly one area where they were kind of, I guess it was a rural area that was kind of depleted of people fleeing to the cities while they were going to kind of, you know, weren't hardly able to keep themselves afloat, so they were looking for people to come and live in that area, and a group of English kind of saw this as an opportunity to have affordable housing, and now it's kind of escalated to the point where the French are having to give the English French lessons, and they no longer have a problem with losing their school or keeping their town afloat or whatever, but they're becoming English-fied instead of being French, which they're not real keen about. And then also it's the English have come in and bought these properties relatively cheaply and have gentrified them, so to speak. And so there, too, they're kind of, the locals are kind of being priced out of the market. So sometimes when you kind of try to fix one problem, you can kind of lead to other problems that can sometimes cause greater issues in the long run, that the ramifications aren't very well thought out well in advance as what they might be.
Yeah, you raise two very good points. One is the one that the previous caller made, and that is that that when someone participates in a community, it's not as though they just have a house. There's a full cultural integration that has to go on, and nations, communities, states seems. I mean, their resources for providing livable support are not inexhaustible. I think anyone who's involved in affordable housing and affordable communities has to, at some point, bump up against the sort of the reality of the scarcity of world's resources, and not be so naive as to think that somewhere, somehow, the world can provide good, decent living for an expanding population. It's just really, really tough to find those resources, and there's a cost for housing that I think anyone like us, those of us here, and those you who call, recognize that it's an uphill struggle to try to make it through, and where resources are scarce. But England, you point out, is sort of reaching its limits, and I know from my experience that France is as well, that they're borrowing a lot of money to make it through some of the commitments that they've had right now, and times are getting tough.
Well, thanks for the comments. We certainly appreciate it. Let's go to Belgium. That is over by Danville, not the country. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to point out a couple of points about a topic you folks have been talking about, and that's Section 8 housing. Section 8 housing, where it does provide housing for individuals, it a lot of times is very unscrupulous about the way they do it. To start with, it comes into an individual will come into a community, when I even say a community, a neighborhood, and pick out houses that are usually less well kept up and buy them. And then the individual put minimal number of dollars into this building, not even a home, a building. And he will then, or she or whoever the person is, will bring in a family. And now I don't want to be prejudicial about anything I'm saying here, but a lot of times the families will move in and the houses will immediately deteriorate. And then the next house next door deteriorates, and it's brought into Section 8 situation. The same owner will fix it up, put another Section 8 family into it. Pretty soon you have a whole area that's been extremely blighted. The families that move in don't really take care of the property at all like the original owners do. They just let it fall down dramatically. The owners are all they're concerned about is getting the check from the government. They don't really like to improve the property. And it just drives a neighborhood down rapidly. That form of providing housing for people who are less capable is really a poor example of trying to keep a community together. Would you like to discuss that? Seeing how I've been around some of those communities, you see it happen over and over again. Would you like to have any comments on that?
I think it's the issue of absentee landlords is not just a Section 8 issue. It's an issue in general when anybody takes over a property that has been a homeowner-occupied property and it makes it into a rental property. There generally seems to be the degrading of that property over time, and there are a number of reasons for that. We can't blame the residents of that property, the renters of that property, be they Section 8 or other renters, completely. They can do some things, but it's really not their responsibility to fix the porch handrail or plant flowers or those kinds of things. Those are in fact the responsibility of the landlord.
I'm not speaking about that sort of things, ma'am. It sometimes it's nice just to keep junk cars off the property, tires from building up.
Right. I agree with I understand what you're saying there, and I think again it may be an issue that is a landlord responsibility. Not that it's their responsibility, the tires and so on, but it's their responsibility to enforce, for example, the city ordinances that would forbid those kinds of things from happening.
Yeah. Also, interesting thing that happens in the Chicagoland area. There are areas that are being gentrified, and people who are in Section 8 housing are advised to move downstate. Let's go to another area. So this valuable property in Chicago can be gentrified. That's an interesting concept that's happening, at least in the Chicago area. It may very well happen in other large cities, too.
Section 8 housing, in fact, any housing, can be poorly managed or well managed. I don't think there's anything inherent in the program or necessarily inherent in absentee landlord communities that necessarily leads to their degradation. I think that management is possible, but it involves expense for the oversight, for the regulation, for getting there and having resources to fix things up, because one of the points that you make, and that is that things sort of go downhill without an attentive, fully invested person. You're absolutely correct. But there are ways that we as a community, I think, can compensate for that.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone in Chicago on line 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm wondering, since government seems to be playing a smaller and smaller role in civic affairs and society in general, is a larger role being taken, say, by private nonprofit companies that put together packages, in other words, that do end up getting some kind of government subsidies and so on? I'm just wondering how this works out in the marketplace.
Actually, since the mid-1980s, the federal government has become less and less involved in the development of housing that would be owned, for example, by a housing authority. And they have changed their mode of operation to providing grants and low-interest loans to nonprofit organizations and nonprofit and for-profit partnerships to develop housing and to manage that housing.
Oh, so you're saying, in effect, that whole aspect is increasing.
Yes,
the nonprofit private organization.
Yes, their responsibility in terms of developing housing, developing new housing, has increased and continues to increase.
I see. Okay, and are they considered generally across the board as doing a fair job?
Well, I think
there must be variation. I don't mean to make a blanket question out of that.
Well, I think we could attack the issue of affordable housing from 100 different directions, and there would still be a need. And I always tell people that it really needs to be lots of different people with lots of different ways of going about it and developing lots of housing, because there is an increasingly large need for affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Well, do you think that given the fact that there are some places where the cost of housing is so high, is it unrealistic for us to be preoccupied with the idea that the goal is owner-occupied housing?
This is an issue very close to my heart. I think that it would be, in an ideal world, it would be great for everybody to own their own housing units. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there are people who don't want that responsibility, people who are not ready to take on that responsibility. And then there are people who really are but don't have the resources. So I think there's a broad range. And we've tended to focus in this country on a one-size-fits-all design solution to housing. So everybody should live in a single-family detached house, which is not possible at this point. We have, attached housing, townhouses, as we get more and more dense, condominiums and other solutions. But I think there's still and always will be a place for rental housing. There's a segment of the population that, and a certain time in people's life course, if you will, where that's an appropriate solution.
Right. Right. I picture the cities as a singles club and people young there and all renters. And then when they hitch up, they move to the picket fence in the suburbs and own a single family house. And then at some point that becomes too burdensome. And as older people, we sort of move in between so we can watch our grandkids in the city and our children in the suburbs. And the place, the community at that point, I think, means more than the actual financing of the house.
We have about 15 minutes left, and maybe I should introduce again our guest, Bill Rose. He's research architect with the U of I Building Research Council. That's a part of the School of Architecture. And also Lynn Dearborn. She is assistant professor of architecture. We're talking about designing and building affordable housing. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Pena, and that's on our line one.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in your architectural program, and I just wanted to mention down here in Christian County, our Christian County Housing Authority appears to have been very successful. We have painted towers, an eight-story building with apartments. We have Park Place, about a three-story, a little more advanced apartments. They have taken down the, well, they were built for World War II veterans, more like row houses, one-story row houses, and replaced them over in Washington Court. This is really what I want to mention. They have replaced them with individual houses of varying design, one- and two-story homes. Some of them are bungalows, some of them are square top houses, and clear down to the sodding of the yards. A very beautiful area. They changed it from these row houses, row apartments, and that is another way of them, I think, meeting the needs of people for low income. I might also mention Taylorville, our county seat, has two large apartment buildings for the low income. And I believe they're also building more over there. Also in Pena, they've just started a groundbreaking for a 47-unit assisted living area for the people. And all these are located right in town where the people have, they can use their transportation. It's they're all very well located, and I just wanted to mention that to add to your program. Thank you.
Well, thanks.
I really appreciate the commenter, because we were directed early on in this show from talking about individual houses to talking about communities, and the gentleman who just described Pena spoke with a lot of pride in his community. He spoke about affordable housing in terms of pride in the community, and it seems to me that if the city can generate programs and pride in those programs, it's a success, it sounds like. I'm not sure of the properties that he's describing, but to have a citizen describing it so forcefully, it makes it sound like a success to me. But he also points out the general drift from multifamily housing to single-family housing, and that has been a drift, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I think As that affordability gap has gotten wider for more people, the dream of the single family house gets modified a little bit, and so maybe it ends up being a townhouse or something. But people tend to still be striving for something of their own somewhere along the way.
Well, if you were looking at something like that, townhouse, condominium, it's something other than the detached single-family home that a lot of people think is the ideal. Does that help with the cost of construction? Is it cheaper to build that kind of a building?
Yes,
it is. So yeah. So if you're asking, well, what can we do to try to keep down the cost of putting up a building like that?
Right.
The kind of building we're talking about is going to determine.
And in fact, as land becomes scarce, that option just drifts away.
Right, because it's not only an issue of construction costs, it's an issue of land costs and density. And so you can get a greater density. And with sensitive design, as an appealing a neighborhood with attached housing.
There's a technical side to that, too. You have to have a really good wall that separates your unit from the other unit in terms of noise and fire and odors, for that matter.
Yeah. When, if you're, I'm thinking, I guess maybe I'm hung up on the single-family house, but if you're thinking about the challenge that one faces as an architect, so if you were going to design some housing like that, and you... You know, we want to say we want to make sure that these houses are attractive, are efficient, energy efficient, are safe, but also affordable. I guess the first thing that I would think of is there are size restrictions. It's probably going to be a smaller house, and it's not going to have some of the amenities that people seem to think they have to have now in houses, including luxurious master suites with 100-gallon soaking tubs and kitchens that are half the size of the house, you know, things like that. The places that really people who have lots of money are putting the money in. What kind of a house are you going to get? I mean, if we said, well, we want to try to build a house that somebody could buy for $70,000, what's that house going to look like? And is it really possible to design something that's going to be attractive and function well? And yet be affordable.
My hunch, and Lynn, you might check on this, is that the sizes of the units has been going up.
Oh, yeah, it has been. I think the average now is around 2,800 square feet for a single-family house as the average. I live in a 1,300-square-foot house, and having moved from a 500-square-foot house, I find that it's quite roomy.
Feels huge, yeah.
But that number has been creeping up, as have the required amenities. And in our market today, I think you'd be looking at probably a house of under 2,000 square feet, 1.5 baths, and not only 3 bedrooms, living room, basic kitchen, and dining area, and that's what you would be looking at.
But perhaps with air conditioning.
Yes, most likely.
Yeah. So it is, and I guess though that again, you know, when you ask, can you design something that's attractive? You have to ask, well, what exactly does that mean? But I suppose that that's where an architect comes in, whether it's actually you can. So much of the housing in this country, I guess somebody designed it, but it's not exactly architect design. You know, somebody builds it and they have floor plans and they say, okay, you can have your bedroom here, you can have your bedroom over there. We can offer you this facade or that facade. You can have a 2-car garage, you can have a 3-car garage, but it may be functional, but it may not necessarily be beautiful. I mean, is it really possible to make something affordable and functional and something that's attractive at the same time?
Well, I think so, and I think that's the biggest challenge that goes to the architects. Can you put this whole thing together? Because it's true that architects are not involved deeply in all projects. Some of the projects really do arise by a process of incremental perfecting. If there's one model for something that works, it tends to be replicated. We don't have to recreate these things time and time again. We don't have to come up with new ideas all the time because some of the old ideas can prove to do well and others don't. And architects often will have a wide view of history, but it's pretty hard for someone to be aware of affordable housing markets in different areas and be able to draw on the best of those. Everybody has to get involved in that project.
And I think it's such a mix of the technology needs and understanding what makes something affordable and where do you give and take, where do you add to the cost that will be most effective. And it means understanding all of the value engineering that goes into the other aspects of it to really understand where am I going to get the most for, you know, making that addition, and where can I back off and really do the minimal.
This is a point very much it's of concern to me. There's a presumption, I think, that our houses, if they're there, if we're building them the way building codes permit with building materials, they'll be just fine as long as they're maintained. But we've been value engineering for some time, and I have several colleagues who are starting to ask the questions, have we crossed the line? Is the way we are building now, with oriented strand board in particular as a sheathing material, have we crossed the line into a building that really can't make it for 100 years no matter how hard we try? Mm-hmm. And if so, that's a cost that really has to be worked into the equation, I believe.
Well, I think that this is a very interesting question and probably worth another program to talk about the way that we build houses now. First of all, the way that they're constructed, and then you have to ask that question, can you really imagine? Like, I have a little house, too, and it's more than 100 years old. And when I go around and I look at some of the houses that are being built today and I say, can you imagine somebody living in that house 100 years from now? I have to say, no, I don't think so. Partly because it's because of the way that it's constructed, but partly also because of the way that it's designed. And you also wonder, what happens when we have, on average, much smaller family size? Is that a house you can grow old in? You have to look at how much of what we're building today, and you have to say, that's not gonna work in the future.
The only saving grace there, I agree with you, I'm pessimistic about it. The only saving grace might be that we're having longer lifespans, and there might be not just three but four generations of people who have to make it into one of these big units. But by no means is the density supportable, sustainable.
And you want to add?
The only thing that I would add is that in that discussion, we should also be looking at other aspects, not just materials. But I think, for example, one thing that we find objectionable is that when you go into a suburban development, all you see are garage doors. Well, that actually is a result of a setback requirement, where if you go into older neighborhoods, you see that they put the garage at the back of the lot because they didn't want that to be what was, but when cost is the most important issue, well, the least driveway I have to pave, the better, so the garage gets pulled to the front. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see. And how does that contribute to the whole sense of community in that area?
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop, and I'm sure that we'll get back to some of these things probably on another day and in other ways, but for the moment we want to say thanks very much to Bill Rose from the Building Research Council and also Lynn Dearborn from the Department of Architecture, U of I. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.